Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome one and all to Web Sleuths Radio. Tonight is our final radio show concerning the Killing Season on A&E. It was such a tremendous show. Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills deserve all the credit. Their crew, they worked years on this show to help expose the fact that sex workers are getting murdered and people don't care. That's basically it. Rachel, is that
hey.
You?
It's Josh and Rachel.
Let's just recap really quickly the last two episodes. I wanted to cry. I mean, it was so sad. But it left us hanging and wanting more. Okay, we had the West Mesa, and then you brought it back around to Long Island again. And so many things have happened. We're going to cover that a little bit later with our guests. But just for those of the listeners that perhaps didn't see it all, at any of it at all, the last two seasons, or last two episodes, if you could please give us a quick recap.
Sure. I think when we last spoke, we were looking at some of the long-haul stuff. And from that, we went to, I guess, what could be considered one of the largest kind of aggregate murders of sex workers in the United States, a case that, interestingly enough, parallels Long Island so distinctly, which is Albuquerque and the West Mesa killings.
Mm-hmm.
There we have 11 women, kind of very similar to Long Island in a sense. And from there, we, you know, look at those murders and then, you know, for those of you who don't know, you know, we spoke to John Robert Williams, who is a, I guess you can call it a long-haul serial killer, self-admittedly. And then he told us that, you know, he knows who it was and in the Gilgo Beach killings. And then we kind of looked at that. We went back to Long Island, found somebody who was very interesting, who had kind of indicated to a lot of people that he was the killer, and we realized he wasn't, but it was just very strange the kind of way he inserted himself. And then from there, Chief Burke was arrested, and that kind of just reopened our eyes. And it was very interesting, you know, and kind of hats off to the Web Sleuth community. Very early in the game, when we started to engage the Web Sleuth community, we met a Web Sleuther named Hawkshaw, former NYPD sergeant, who had told us that there was this conspiracy, basically, involved. And, you know, it's not that we didn't believe him. It's just that we all kind of create a lot of conspiracies. And he indicated that some of the upper echelon in that department were somewhat not involved, but, you know, had been doing nefarious things. It's not that we didn't believe him, but I guess it was just seemed kind of too fantastical. And then with Burke getting arrested, it was right. You know, basically, we're not, of course, not saying that Burke is somehow the Long Island serial killer. And yes, a lot of people kind of like to go there. I think that would be more along the lines of a narrative series than true. But there is no denying that he had a lot of relations with sex workers. And when you just look at it from, like, you know, a law enforcement perspective and from the perspective of, is this guy really, you know, the right person to lead this investigation, it obviously becomes a no. And what's even tragically worse is the fact that, yes, he was involved in involved with sex workers. And he was also surveilling some of his own detectives. And, you know, he was intentionally dragging his heels in this Gilgo Beach murder investigation. And, you know, when the detectives had asked for some help, he and along with Spoda said no. And I don't know why anybody would say no to the FBI. You know, there are some people out there.
He just didn't want to see his, you know, he didn't want anybody interfering with what he was doing. He didn't want the eyes looking on him.
Right, because he was doing some very bad things. You know, he was, you know, kind of political cronyism and surveilling his own detectives and even, you know, kind of using listening devices and everything. And so it's just a bad look for the Suffolk County Police Department. And it just goes to show that, you know, there was an attempt made to kind of obstruct the forward progress of this case. And it's very sad. But thankfully, the new commissioner, Commissioner Singh, was very open and kind of listened. And I think, you know, hopefully something positive is going to happen. And then from there, we hooked back up with Tom Hargrove, who was on the show last week. And we started to look at other cases. You know, the whole thing is about using the data to kind of look for other serial murders that police have not admitted to or police don't even quite know about because they don't really use the data to in the way that that we should be, in the way that a lot of other private industries use data to really kind of source the clues, basically.
And one thing I think is interesting about Tom Hargrove and his work in documenting and counting all of the murders, a lot of people don't know this, but in his Murder Accountability Project, he and his organization actually sued police departments for not putting in the proper data. And you've got to applaud that. That is just fantastic. You know,
it's just weird. It kind of goes against what we believe, what the media shows us when it comes to the police kind of, I guess, you know, solving these cases. You know, again, we all have this ideology that the police are putting our data into supercomputers 24/7 and they're putting all these murders in and somehow they're all linking it up and checking things, and unfortunately we're missing a lot of murders. We're missing a lot of connections. And you know, it's amazing, like, for all the talk we have about the behavioral science unit and all that stuff, to find out that it's really not as kind of top-notch in terms of being able to look at the data and kind of find those connections, it's a little disturbing.
It's very disturbing because everybody just assumes, hey, these agencies talk to each other, they keep track of these things, and they don't. And what that does, Josh, is obviously it gives the serial killer a heads up, a foot up from the police because they can just move around and nobody will know. It's just so darn frustrating. We're going to talk to Greg Cooper tonight about VICAP, and there's still information waiting to be inputted. That is not, I mean, thousands of names. It's beyond frustrating. And that's why I feel, and I know I can speak for everybody at Web Sleuths, that the killing season was so important. You and Rachel brought up so many things that we had no clue existed. And thank God that you did. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it was truly, truly shocking. Truly shocking
to find out.
You know, like, what we're fed in the media, and this is, listen, this is our fault. This is this is the law and orders. This is the, you know, the CSIs. This is all, you know, I guess we have to realize that we can't believe sometimes what, you know, those shows are saying, and that we really have to kind of do the work for ourselves. And I don't mean to get conspiratorial about it, because that's the last thing that we want to do. We don't want to create narratives that aren't true, but at the same time, I think we also want to just question and say, you know, what's going on with the data? I really do have to admit, I can't believe that there are not law enforcement agencies and news organizations all across the country that aren't picking this up like I was hoping they would. That they're not like, what? Murder is not better.
Yeah,
than mandated.
This is really happening. Exactly.
it was so shocking to me, and so I was just blown away.
Well, I'll tell you what. We have Jeff Proctor on the line with us now. Let's welcome him from Albuquerque, and
Jeff,
welcome to Web Sleuths Radio. We have Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills on the line. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. How about you?
I am doing great now. Jeff, you are an award-winning journalist, and you have a fascinating story to tell. Josh, I'm going to turn it over to you because I'm telling you, what Jeff has to say, will just it's good stuff. Hang on. Go ahead, Josh.
Well, thank you, first of all. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. How are you, Josh?
Not bad. Thanks for, first of all, participating in our show. And I think more importantly, thank you for kind of revealing a little bit of the truth about what's going on out there.
It's my pleasure and my job. Thanks for saying so, and I enjoyed participating in the show.
Great. So, you know, one of the most amazing things, and I'm not quite sure about the story you're going to tell us, but I'm excited to hear it. But on top of that, there's been some interesting news happened since we did that investigation. Is that correct?
Some friends of mine at the newspaper where I used to work at the Albuquerque Journal recently unearthed some records that had been buried for a long time related to one of the suspects. That's right.
So can you tell us a little bit about what happened?
Sure. The breaking news and crime team at the Journal, Robert Broman, Nicole Perez, and Elise Kaplan, had been kind of poking around at trying to get some records related to Lorenzo Montoya, one of the West Mesa murder suspects, for months and months and months. And finally, we're able to pry some of those records loose from the police department here. They showed some interesting and kind of disturbing things. They were able to get their hands on some video recordings that he had made, kind of home movies. Some of them were sex tapes, for lack of a better way of saying that, and some other records too related to some potential insurance fraud that he was up to, that he had set fire to a couple of vehicles, those kinds of things.
And I guess one of the interesting things is that, and maybe you can explain it, you know, everybody, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, what about FOIA requests, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests? I mean, we requested this information from the police department in Albuquerque, but they didn't give it to us. Why didn't, you know, why when you ask for these videos that are sitting there in the files, why don't we get them when we ask for them? Isn't that our right?
It is, and actually New Mexico has a pretty good sunshine law called the Inspection of Public Records Act. I've been frustrated for a long, long time related to the West Mesa case and any number of other records inquiries in my reporting on the police department for years and years and years. It's an agency that has struggled with transparency, to put it kind of mildly. I've made a number of records requests through the years related to the West Mesa case as well, that probably should have produced those records years ago. They were able to get those records by kind of circumventing the process. It's my understanding that they went through the records window, which is just sort of the walk-up request a police report window that's in the main police station downtown here in Albuquerque, which was a pretty creative way to try to go about getting a huge trove of records. They did that rather than going through the formal process of submitting a request under the Inspection of Public Records Act, and that's how they were able to get their hands on those videos and the other records they used to put their story together.
Hey, it's Rachel here. How's it going?
Hey, Rachel. It's going well. Thanks.
Hey, good. Good to hear from you. Hey, just out of curiosity, what can we do just moving forward to get more transparency out of organizations like APD?
Well, that's a great question and a fight that I've been engaged in now for 15 years, trying to get more transparency out of them. I've filed lawsuits. Two of which I've won to get records from them. Unfortunately, neither of those lawsuits went all the way to the trial phase where we could have made a real policy change in terms of the way they deal with public records requests. I'm also on the board of the local chapter of the Society of Professional Journalists, and we agitate and advocate for transparency on a regular basis, not just with the police department, but with any number of other government entities here. I've tried shame. You know, I've written countless stories about their lack of transparency, about the way they seem to be pretty cavalier with records that in the end actually do belong to the public. I really don't know what it's going to take culturally to get that police department more in line with the sort of core principles of transparent government.
Well, you know, it's very interesting because I think one of the big takeaways from the show is that of the five police agencies we looked at, three of them were under investigation by the Department of Justice for civil rights violations. And when I mean civil rights, I mean shootings and things like that. You know, this is not – we're not here to dump on law enforcement. We're actually here to try and just find a better working relationship. And tragically, these murders of sex workers, the serial murders, kind of are the worst-case scenario. How does APD stack up with some of the other places where we've looked at and where you've looked at in terms of police departments?
Well, the city of Albuquerque, broadly speaking, is one of the handful, very small handful of least transparent governments in the state of New Mexico. The police department probably being the worst offender among the different agencies in the city. So it stacks up pretty poorly. There are government entities in New Mexico that do a good job of transparency. There are police departments in New Mexico that do a good job of transparency. And one kind of hallmark of that is, you know, generally speaking, if you have an officer who violates policy or violates someone's civil rights, it really shouldn't be on a journalist like me to dig that out of the dirt. Department should be volunteering. Hey, we did an internal investigation, found that this guy, you know, violated some policies, and we're disciplining him as a result. So there are police agencies here in New Mexico and elsewhere in the Southwest, which is kind of my coverage area, that do a good job of transparency. I think law enforcement generally is kind of slow to the transparency table. And part of that is because of the sensitive nature of some of the work that they do. Part of it also is kind of a warrior culture, I think, that comes with a lot of law enforcement, sort of, you know, don't question the way I do my job, that sort of thing. So it's I think it's a complicated stew.
It is. So tell us, I think you had a story that, if I'm not mistaken, that you had to tell us about? No?
A story that I wrote
journal,
recently?
Well, I don't know. Well, Tricia was saying that you had a story that you were going to – go ahead, Trish.
Well, I think he touched on it on the, in the beginning about the videotapes and this possible serial killer. Jeff, you know about the old videotapes. They're trying to find the women, and are you familiar with that story?
Yes, quite. That's the story I was describing just a moment ago. That was
written by
my friends at the journal.
And you know, actually, Jeff, I think one thing is, so knowing that there are these videos of Lorenzo Montoya, in the video are these women. The videos are very creepy. I mean, it's the sound of him unfurling duct tape, you know, while the camera is, like, looking away. And I think, Rach, you're going to be posting those videos. Is that correct, right? You're going to be posting those videos. So I guess the question is, does that make Lorenzo Montoya more of a suspect or less?
I'm not sure it changes his status in terms of where he might sit on the totem pole of the couple of suspects that they do have. To be perfectly honest with you, other than sort of the visceral and creepy nature of that particular piece of video you're talking about, where you can hear the duct tape being torn off of the roll there, and then some of this information about, that he was setting fire to cars, I think that's all interesting information and does kind of round out the character profile a little bit on Lorenzo Montoya, but there is literally no evidence whatsoever in that new story that ties him to the West Mesa case. I think it's important for people to know that. I know that when you watch that video, you're right. It's very, very creepy. It's very, it's dark and it's sinister and all of those things. But again, there's nothing new in terms of the West Mesa murders case in those records that my friends reported on.
And just, I think our show only came out a couple of days ago, but has there been any grumblings that you've heard, like, anything that's come out of it, any positive news whatsoever, even if it's just more exposure?
It may be a little early to say whether the show has prompted a renewed push to get to the bottom of this or to, finally say something public about it. I know a lot of people here did watch the show, and I have spoken to a lot of kind of current and former law enforcement people who've been involved in the West Mesa investigation through the years, who frankly were glad to see some renewed focus on the case and a kind of a new take and a new look at the case. So I think it's more sunshine is always best. And like I was talking about earlier, when you ask about how to kind of force agencies that are allergic to it into a more transparent posture, I mentioned shame. And frankly, your piece did, I'm not sure that it shamed the agency so much, but it did have that kind of good accountability focus. And really at its center, which has been the come from for my work on this case for all of these years, how is it possible that this happened in this city, it remains unsolved. And really for the last handful of years, there's just been no discernible effort made, to bring closure to those families or justice potentially to the person responsible for doing it. So it's tough to say again, whether we're going to get a new investigative push out of this or a press conference, which would be, like mama from heaven, frankly, for them to maybe have a press conference and speak publicly more about the case. But yes, some grumblings behind the curtains for sure. And sometimes it's the butterfly effect thing, right? Butterfly flaps its wings and you never know when the wave will wash up on shore.
Right. One thing that we didn't put in the series that it was unfortunate to me, but one thing you and I spoke about quite a bit was trying to get a memorial. Can you kind of just explain a little bit, what was going on with this idea of this memorial on those hollow grounds, I guess?
Yes. The city has long said that if they could get the owner of that property, the development company, KB Home, to donate some land out there, that the city would kick in the money, design, and build a memorial park for the victims of the West Mesa murders. That was an idea that just sort of got deep-sixed for a long period of time. There was some renewed pressure from the news media here starting, we're coming up now on 3 years ago. I did a story almost 3 years ago at the five-year anniversary mark, finally naming one of the primary suspect in the case as a suspect. The Journal did a couple of stories since then, and there was some movement in the city council to appropriate money to build this park, and it seemed like a deal was imminent. That money did, in fact, get appropriated, but unfortunately, since then, there hasn't been nobody's broken ground. Nobody's turned a shovel of dirt out there yet to get this started. But the money is in the pipeline now.
Right. Okay. So, you know, and just in full disclosure to the audience, Jeff and I were talking to K&B to try and get them to donate the land. They were willing to donate the land. I think we got them to say that they would even raise, you know, at least like, you know, kind of make it flat. And then we were trying to get the city to kind of take ownership back of that land. And I don't know how far we got. I mean, both sides, you know, it felt like a hot potato that nobody really wanted to touch, you know. But we felt like, and I speak for me and myself and Rachel, like, you know, even if you don't find the murderer, okay. I mean, it's not okay, but the least you can do is create a kind of memorial, you know, and that would be an easy get, but I guess it's just not so easy, is it?
Yeah, it has proven elusive would be a kind way to say it. It's one of those conversations that fires up, you know, every year around the anniversary of this. Hey, whatever happened to that park you guys were going to build out there? And again, it sounds like now there has been some discussion between the developer and the city. Some money has been appropriated in the budget to make this happen, but certainly nobody has sat down and put the ink on the paper that says, okay, the land now belongs to the city again. Let's dust that old rendering of the park out of the mothballs and actually get this thing started. So maybe that will happen. Certainly these are questions that we will continue. I know I will continue to answer or ask as I write more stories about this case going forward. That I think is one of the kind of real tension points and spots where there is some possibility for movement to get that park built.
Well, look, if nothing else, I hope that we can get that park. Jeff, I want to thank you for being such a kind of hardcore take no prisoners journalist about this. And we were impressed with the way that you continue to fight, and we know that there's a bunch of other journalists in Albuquerque who continue to fight the good fight. So thank you very much for all that you're doing.
You bet. Thanks for having me on the radio, and thank you again for putting a spotlight on this case. It's just it's something that I wish there had been more of through the years.
I have a couple of questions, if you can hang on just for a moment, Jeff, okay? First of all, let's go back to the Freedom of Information Act. You said earlier that, and I agree, I think everybody agrees, that you shouldn't even have to do a Freedom of Information Act. The police should say, hey, this guy has been doing this and that, and we're taking care of it. They should be forward and move everything to the front, but they don't. Do you think there's anything left that they haven't turned over that they should have? If so, would it help if just regular people, not journalists, but just requested the Freedom of Information Act and sent in their request for this information? Do you think that would do any good at all?
To be perfectly honest with you, I think that would further gum up the works. To answer your first question, I do believe that there is a huge amount of documentation and information that they've never turned over related to this case. There are investigative files, probably transcripts and notes from interviews. There's a lot of paper on this case sitting in their files that we still have never had a look at. And I say that it would gum up the works. That said, I think people should be using the New Mexico Inspection of Public Records Act to demand that they turn this stuff over. At this point, you know, their argument that this is an active, ongoing investigation, and that's their rationale for withholding these records from the public, frankly, that rings really, really hollow at this point. It's going to be 8 years here in just a couple of months since they first began to unearth the bones out on the West Mesa here. I think it's high time that they made that whole case file public.
Wow.
Couldn't agree more. Jeff Proctor, thank you for joining us tonight. And, hey, we're going to have you on again, I know, because we'll be talking about this case until it is solved. So thank you, Jeff. Take care now.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having me. You too.
Bye-bye. We have a great guest on the phone. I know that when I hear him describe that that video that the police found, you know, you can hear the tape and the garbage. It just, it is so creepy, Josh. And it's, the thing is, it's real. These monsters are real. That's what's so hard to grasp. So I can't wait for Rachel to put, it's important for everybody to watch this video, at least hear what's going on in the background, right?
Yeah, you know, God, watching that video the first time, it was incredibly creepy. You know, hearing all those sounds in the background, you know, your imagination just goes wild. The crazy thing is those videos mm-hmm. are from 2005, 2006. We're not exactly sure. You know, I think a lot of people point the finger to Lorenzo Montoya, and, you know, I don't think we're crazy to point the finger to Lorenzo Montoya, but mm-hmm. there's still no concrete evidence that he is responsible for the 11 victims found on the West Mesa. That's not to say that he's not responsible for one death, which we know exists, which is Sharika Hill. He was caught mm-hmm. literally red-handed. So, you know, the troubling thing for me is that it wasn't as though Albuquerque Police Department just came forward and said, hey, we have this video of, you know, from Lorenzo Montoya that we got in 2006, and we want to see if anybody recognizes his woman. They didn't do that. Mm-hmm. They've been sitting on this for a while, and it, you know, boiled down to journalists coming forward and saying, you know, hey, here's this freedom information act. We've been trying to get this for a while. Will you release this to us? And then, you know, someone in records decided, you know what, this is the right thing to do. And finally, mm-hmm. as of, like, beginning of October, decided to do so. You know, I can't say what would have happened if they had decided, in my opinion, to do the right thing, which is release that information back in 2000, I believe it was 2006. You know, there's women on those videos. There's women on those tapes that can be identified who, you know, someone – for instance, like Christine, could have said, you know what, I recognize that woman. I just saw her the other day, and maybe she knows something. And you know what, it could just be to clear his name. We don't know. But that's the frustrating thing for me, is that that was out there. We didn't know it was out there necessarily. It's out there now, and I don't know if Christine's on the line right now, but I know that she recognized
is.
Some of those women.
She is, and let's introduce her now. This is Christine Barber. And she runs an organization called Street Safe New Mexico. It's nonprofit, and it advocates for women who are addicted, homeless, and do street-based sex work. And what an incredible job you do. Christine, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
You're okay. And Rachel, why don't you go ahead and present that question to Christine, and we can just
sure.
Take it from there. That'd be great.
Yeah, you know what, Christine, I'm interested to know if Albuquerque Police Department came forward and said, look, we have these materials. Do you know any of these women? If they didn't do that, and when that material was known to you, whether it was presented by them or not.
So, Rachel and Josh, it was really the article in the newspaper after the intrepid journalists went and got the information and said, hey, we have these women who are shown in this video, here are some stills of the video, and here are the women. At no point has anybody from the Albuquerque Police Department ever come and contacted us. So we said, our group was like, well, you know, we know all of these women, including women who have been on the street and doing prostitution since that time. I guess we'll help. So we put it, we have a list we hand out of all the men who are currently trying to hurt women and kill them on the street, and we put it on that list. And within minutes of me doing that and handing it physically to women who work as prostitutes, they're like, oh, yeah, that totally looks like – and so we had IDs on them almost immediately. I think your question about had they released this back in 2006 is a really legitimate one, because mm-hmm. clearly these women are identifiable up to, I mean, if they end up being the right women, the women are identifiable. And so they could have had this, if Lorenzo Montoya was, he's definitely a killer, but whether he was the West Mesa killer or not, we could have kind of had a lot more information back when people's memories were still fresh. But so we now we have what the names of these women, and I actually one of the women was one of the first women I met after I started doing my work 6 years ago, and the first thing she told me was I was once picked up by the West Mesa Killer. And so we have a woman who is positively ID'd, being in this video, who has said years ago that she was picked up by the West Mesa Killer, and I have cannot figure out for the life of me who to give that information to. I have emailed and called every single person in law enforcement I can think of, and I don't know what to do with this information.
Have you called the Albuquerque Police Department and said, like, I have this information, and have they been responsive at all?
So I haven't done that blatant of an attempt, but I have emailed, I have called people I know, and I'm like, hey, would you happen to know? Just calling the regular number, I haven't tried that yet. That seems a little, it could smack of being a little bit weird and crazy, but no one can even seem to figure out who I'm supposed to talk to. So I think this goes back to the issue that keeps coming and coming and coming to the front and is the scariest thing I think about your entire series, which is Josh said something in one of the first episodes, which was basically, how do you solve a case if the police refuse to talk about it? And that's exactly what this is again. And it's just over and over and over. And it's like what Jeff Proctor was just saying about transparency. It's the same, all the same thing. It's kind of getting old.
Right. Can I just ask a question? You know, I mean, do we really – I'll be honest, and you may disagree with me. I don't think that these individual police officers don't – you know, they don't not care. Excuse me for using a double negative, but they care. It's – right? I mean, it's something else that we're dealing with here, right?
Yes, and that is such an important point. The individual officers and detectives, they really do want to help, and they really do want to do the right thing and be responsive and all of those things. They went into being law enforcement to help people. It is this systemic kind of sickness almost that anybody who's not police is them. Like there's an us and there's a them. You're a police officer, right. So you're an us. If you're not, you're a them, and the them don't get any information because you're not one of us. And I have had my fill of that.
Right. You know, there's another thing that I think we were quite shocked at. I mean, it became very apparent after dealing with and seeing the women that you were dealing with on the streets of Albuquerque, and especially coming from West Virginia, where, you know, we were seeing a town that was just kind of like a zombie town, you know, with the opiates. And then when we were filming women in Albuquerque and, you know, drugs were rampant there. Remember, Rach, we had learned that even like grandmothers would give their kids,
oh my God,
you know, an injection because they didn't want their children or their grandchildren to learn to pick up kind of drugs on the street, you know, and I guess it's in a crazy way, it's like your parents giving you a beer, you know, so that you don't take your first beer out, you know, while driving around. You know, I kind of understand the logic. But one of the things that we were shocked about was that there was no services. You know, there were no services for these women who were addicted. And as a result, it kind of fed into this negative system of these women prostituting themselves and then just becoming, you know, victims of homicide. Is it really that bad? I mean, were there really, and maybe my memory is failing me, but was there like no services for these addicted individuals?
There are services, and it's just that it's very disjointed. And so if a woman, and this happens to us all the time, a woman comes to us, one of our clients comes to us and says, I am done being out here in the street. I want to get help. I want to get clean. we have to line up a minimum of 4 to 5 agencies almost immediately to help her. And so we have to get contact with it, make sure they have a bed available, make sure they can take her in the next step, because it is a stepwise process. And this is going to be true for almost anywhere in the country. So someone wants to get off of drugs, they're hardcore addicted, they're IV drug user, first thing they got to do is they got to go through detox. That's 7 days. That's one agency, and they have to have a bed. Second thing they have to do is probably go through 30 days of rehab. That's your second agency, plus you need a case manager, plus you probably need a doctor. So that's your next 30 days. After that, these women are homeless. These women are – they have everybody they know is in prostitution and drugs. They can't go back to whatever life they have, but they also have no education. Our girls have most of them have a 7th grade education or less. A lot of them are illiterate. And so there's a lot of stuff has to happen before they can be on their own. So then you end up with this whole other group that you have to put them in with for another year at a minimum, and then transitional housing beyond that, because they still can't take care of themselves.
Many hurdles.
Yeah, it is. And it's pretty insurmountable.
Yeah, you know, one thing we didn't include in the series, and I wish we did, I say this a lot, you print this list, this bad day list. And for the folks listening, this is not like this guy doesn't pay for dinner and expects sex. This is the guy has removed the door handles of the car and instead put glass, like glued glass on the door handles so that when he locks the door, you can't escape, like full-on serious serial killer stuff. Can anybody see this thing online? Just because, like, if you want to know how bad it is, if you want to know how crazy effed up it is, check this list out. Where can people see that list?
Josh, that list is available on our website, and our website is streetsafenm.org. So that's Street Safe and N as in Nancy, M as in Montaño. I'm from New Mexico, so I have to say that. .org. And it's called the Bad Guy List. And so it's exactly what Josh describes. The girls, we go out to the girls and do outreach. We literally stand in a parking lot, and we've been doing this for years. And so the girls trust us. And so when they get attacked, the vast majority of time, they never go to police. Only in 3% of these attacks do they ever go to police. I personally took 200 rape reports last year, and so of those, only 2% were ever reported. But we put them on a list, and we hand that list out to the girls, and we give the list to the police as well. But nothing ever comes of it because the girls they're not a complaining victim, so there's no investigation ever. But we put the list online. The entire list is online, going back to really well back to 2011. I think before that goes to 2008. And let me tell you, Josh is not exaggerating. We have guys who have chloroformed the girls. We have guys who have kidnapped the girls. We have guys, 13, we found it. So we have all this data from all of these years, these hundreds and hundreds of reports of men who were just in Albuquerque attacking women. 13% will outfit their cars solely to kidnap the girls. They'll rig the seat belts so that once you put the seat, he'll go, oh, put the seat belt on as soon as you get in. She puts the seat belt on, she can't unlock it anymore. They'll make it so you can't use the door handle. You can't. So and they'll have the entire car like ready to go as their own little kidnapping station. You know, they'll have their weapons, and they'll duct tape, and a lot of times plastic sheeting in the back. So it is that bad, and the girls get attacked like that about once a month. It's as bad as
Are you forwarding this list to the police? Is the police, like, going after, like, can we all talk about it? If we can't talk about it from an empathy way, can we talk about it from a money way? Like, hey, use this list, save money so that you don't have to go out and spend millions of dollars, you know, digging up 75 football fields. Like, it's just cheaper, for Christ's sakes.
Yeah, it is. So, you brought up a good point, which is this list, the next West Mesa killer is on this list. I mean, they could just, they have this whole list of these men who are out doing these horrible things. But none of them are ever investigated. So we pass the list along every single week, and we've been doing this for 6 years, actually 7 years now that we've been an organization. Every single week we say, hey, here's a guy. He, you know, they grabbed this girl off the street, held her for 3 days, and she was able to escape. You know, hey, do you want more information? No, it has never, never happened. We're getting to the point where we are so frustrated we're getting ready to file a civil lawsuit because this is ridiculous. These
women are being raped.
Sorry.
Yeah, I have one last question. Just, you know, these women are being preyed upon on a daily basis. I'm wondering, and when I first started talking to you, Christine, like over a year ago, you were saying how so many of these women don't come forward to police when they are raped, because they do have a choice. Obviously, they're taking dates, but they do have a choice. And sometimes they don't admit to the rapes because, and correct me if I'm wrong, because if they have any kind of arrest record, they can't be accepted or something like that. Can you give a little bit of clarity on that?
Of course. So if you have a warrant out for your arrest, you actually can get arrested when you're reporting the rape. There's nothing stopping them from that. So if I have a warrant out for my arrest, and sometimes they don't know because they're homeless and the stuff gets sent to their address, but they don't have an address. So going to the cops is always a gamble. So if you have a warrant for your arrest, the cop is probably more likely to arrest you for that warrant than to listen to you about the rape. In fact, we had one police officer in the last year who did not laugh and tell the girl she deserved it when they reported the rape.
Mm.
We actually wrote her a thank you note because we had never heard that happen before. Mm. We have instance after instance after instance of the cop laughing, telling the girl she deserved it, telling her that she shouldn't have been doing dates, you know, things like that. So it's a pretty brutal, brutal life and pretty brutal system.
Right.
And I think it goes back to, again, the idea that there needs to be a big systemic change here. So,
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate all the time you gave us when we were out there and continuing to talk to us and giving us updates on the climate of Albuquerque in the streets.
Well, thank you guys for bringing such an amazing show on the air. It was fascinating. I have to admit, there was one point where I was yelling at the screen going, Rachel, Josh, don't go in the creepy basement. I was yelling that at the screen. So.
Exactly.
Christine,
I have a couple of questions if you have just a few more minutes.
Of course.
First of all, you're talking about the women when they go into rehab and they detox for 7 days. Is that cold turkey or are they given medicine to help them?
So the vast majority of the time it's cold turkey, they're not given any medicine. There's no reason for them not to get medicine. They, in fact, in my opinion, should be getting medicine, but they're
absolutely
not. And that's just the way it is. Normally by day five or six, the drug is so far out of their system, they have to think about everything that starts to happen, and that's when you have if you're going to lose someone, that's when you lose them. Because so much bad stuff has happened by that point that the drug has been covering it up. All those 30, 40 rapes that she's been through, which is not an exaggeration, come to the surface on that fifth day when she doesn't have the drug to protect her anymore. And she's out the door because she knows one thing that'll solve that, that'll make that go out of her head, those horrible things. And it's on the street and she can go buy it. Yeah. So.
And it just seems like it's almost a punishment. I would think if you were trying to get someone into rehab, you would say, look, we can give you medicine to help you through this. When they go cold turkey, they get really, really sick. And that's just going to be something that is not going to appeal to them. They're going to want to stay well and like you said, stay kind of in that cloud so they don't have to deal with anything. I don't know. It just seems like they're trying to punish the women because they're trying to get straight. It just doesn't make any sense to me. But second question, I'm on your site, and I'm trying to find the bad guy list. Do you know where it is on your site? I can't seem to find it. I just want to be able to tell our listeners how to get there. And maybe if it's not on your site, is there another place we could find it?
So it's absolutely on the site. You should be able to go up to the once you're off of the intro page, there's like a welcome
mm-hmm.
page. Once you're off of that page, there's a menu at the top right-hand corner of the screen, and so you can just put on there, click on there. It should be a more button. So click on the more button, and it should pop up there.
Okay, and it says about us, what we do, prostitute versus trafficking, and videos.
So if the bad guy list is not there, that is a whole new issue because that has been happening twice.
Well, listen,
I'll check
I'm really bad at computers, and so that's why I wanted to check because more than likely it was my fault, and it probably still is. But
I'm so sorry.
Oh, it is
under what
you do?
Okay,
hold on.
Great.
Under what you do.
Well, again,
bad guy.
I encourage everybody to see that list because I remember, Christine, when you showed it to me, I was just like, oh, my God, this is a roadmap to finding out who these individuals are. There's one other thing, and this was just in the press today, or I guess it was yesterday. Interestingly enough, in the Long Island newspaper, which is Newsday, that finally they are starting to process more rape kits. I'll read you the headline that says, sex assaults in New York, this is Long Island Newsday, Monday, December 5th, new law to unlock evidence. State will test backlog of rape kits that could yield DNA matches. And to me, like, okay, we should obviously just be testing rape kits because a crime has been committed and, we should be testing rape kits. But besides that, as somebody who kind of is looking at the ways in which we can better track serial murders, the fact that these rape kits lead to so many serial murders, and because serial rape leads to serial murder. It's like peanut butter and chocolate, you know. So are you guys seeing that on the West Coast as well, I guess?
So that's you're completely correct. And I think that's a problem that we've seen across the country with these rape kits. And it is a very much a you wonder often how they got to such a bad backlog. You'll see stories,
yeah.
And we definitely had that here, 3,000, 4,000 backlog. And you're like, well, how did you even get to that point? So, yeah, absolutely. And I don't even know how to solve that problem except, having a lot of people work overtime.
Right, because it does cost quite a bit of money. And obviously, we might say we're a bunch of liberals just sitting there saying, like, why are we doing this? And not really understanding how much money it costs and all those things. It's weird. I guess I just go back to how much money we spend on these hardcore investigations of serial murder and realizing that maybe a little bit up front would help. Maybe it's pressure to – one thing I do actually know from looking at and from interviewing, we went to a DNA lab in Daytona because we were looking at the issues of familial DNA testing. That was in the Bitroff case in Long Island, which actually found some cases, and it actually has been in a lot of other places. One of the problems is that every law enforcement agency is now sending in their DNA. It becomes such an important tool for law enforcement, but it's almost too important, meaning that's the first order of business. And so these places get so backlogged. And so what we really need is a lot more labs if this is really going to be the de facto kind of tool that we're using. It's labs and it's databases,
And
I
agree with
that's
you
something
on that,
we have to advocate for.
If you go to something like the West Mesa case, though, and this might be the case in Long Island as well, which is there's no DNA evidence. And so you end up having to go back to old-fashioned police work, which is why I really have to commend you and Rachel for putting the videos up, because I feel like the more we get information out there, the more people are going to be able to like, wait a second, I recognize the background in that video of this creepy guy.
Right.
I knew. So, I mean, that kind of thing. So,
right.
Yeah, I completely agree with the backlog of DNA and that there needs to be more labs, but the whole thing, and plus it's actually not even a short, doing genetic testing for that is a minimum six hour test for each one.
Wow.
So it takes a lot. It takes a while.
Right. Well, Christine, thank you. You know, a lot of people have been kind of advocating for us to have a person who represents sex workers on the show. And so kind of thank you for doing that. You know, I think, you know, there's a lot of – actually, I do have one other question, and I apologize because this is something that we deal with all the time. A lot of pro-sex worker people, you know, they want us to portray this sex work as a choice, and I totally understand that. I guess what we also have to realize is that we're also dealing with a large part of the community, the women that we've been looking at, who don't view this sex work as a choice. And how do you reconcile the difference of the two?
So you've hit on a problem, which is there are definitely people who do this work who this is what they want to do. They're really interested. They just like sex. We in the business are referred to as indoor sex workers because this is a life they've chosen because they had options because they had education, they could go on to college, they could, even with all those options, this is what they chose. The women you interviewed and the women we work with, there was no other option. A lot of them were on the street as 12, 13, 14-year-olds. I mean, that's when they started this. There's only a choice if there is an actual choice
Choices.
Involved. If you are given
right.
options. If you're not given options, it's not an actual choice. It's just this is what you have to do because there is nothing else.
Right. Okay. Well, Christine, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for all your help. And, you know, we want to know what's going to happen in Albuquerque.
I will keep you up to date.
Hey, it's Rachel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you,
yeah,
Christine.
Keep in touch,
okay? Right. Thank you, Josh. Thanks, Rachel. Thanks, Tricia.
You're welcome, Christine Barber, everybody. And now we're going to go to one of our Web Sleuth members and mine, favorite person. That's Bob Kolker. Bob is the author of The Lost Girls. And by the way, it was a New York Times best-selling book. It was named one of New York Times' 100 notable books and one of Publisher Weekly's top 10 books for 2013. Author of Lost Girls, Bob Kolker, thank you for joining us tonight, Bob. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. Thanks, Tricia. And hi, Josh. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. You know, and also just to add one more accolade, Lost Girls is the reason why we made our series.
There you go.
I mean, that's wonderful to hear. You guys did a wonderful job. I've said this at a few events for the series, but I want to say it now to Web Sleuth members. It really is a great piece of work all the way through. I mean, the parts of it about Long Island were of special interest to me, but then my mind was really blown as you guys went from place to place around the country, finding similar situations, similar journalists like myself who had been, you know, working on these stories in the background, and then you actually found really helpful and interesting leads on Web Sleuth itself that it's almost like you went mining for gold and kept finding gold dust everywhere you went. It really is quite an accomplishment you guys did.
Well, thank you, and you know, it's I guess it's more sad than anything, right? We had to go to all those places, but it's nice to see that there are good journalists out there. It's kind of like a little bit like Spotlight. You know what I'm saying? Like there are people kind of out there fighting the good fight. You were one of them. So thank you for that. But, you know, I know everybody is really eager to kind of talk about some of the updates in the Long Island case. And there's one update which we didn't even include. And that was because I just didn't think it was appropriate. But I think it's appropriate for us to talk about because I think it kind of I don't know. I'm really torn about it. But the fact about Mary Gilbert's murder, can you just let everybody know kind of what happened and your take on it? And is it – not that it's related, but how does it relate, you know, to what we're talking about?
Sure. Mary Gilbert was Shannon Gilbert's mother. she figures prominently in my book, in my account of Shannon's life, and she figured prominently in the case itself as it became public. The victim's family members, to the extent that they made any sort of impact in the media, it was because of Mary. She was the squeaky wheel who was really getting the attention of the media, primarily perhaps because Shannon was missing for quite some time before her body was finally found, but also because of her own personality. And so she became a focal point of sorts. And she also became a figure that the police, or some of them, ended up resenting and making cracks about behind her back. Really an electric presence she was. And then in the years following the publication of my book in 2013, Mary and her family really were concentrating on two things. The first was to try to find justice for their daughter, to try to continue to find out what happened to her that night in Oak Beach and see if it was connected to the Lisk case. And then the second thing was more private, and it was to deal with the mental illness of a sister of Shannon's named Sarah. Sarah I only met maybe once in reporting the book. She kept a very, you know, she was very quiet. I believe she might have been interviewed in a couple of the, you know, documentaries back then, but really not, it really was sort of in the background. But it turns out that she was suffering from schizophrenia, and the disease got aggravated by the trauma of her sister's murder. And she started to decompensate over the years, and they were spending a lot of time, not just Mary, but other daughters of hers, Cherie and Stevie, trying to take care of her and keep her from harming herself or others. And this past summer in July, in a horrible tragedy, Sarah ended up murdering Mary. And she is under arrest and incarcerated at the moment and awaiting trial. Her lawyer is John Ray, who is the same lawyer who represents the Gilbert family in the civil suit against Dr. Peter Hackett. John Ray you saw on The Killing Season. John Ray is trying to put in an insanity plea for Sarah. It would seem to be a slam dunk, but the judge is resisting at the moment, and that's where we're at. It's a terrible situation all the way around, and it's unbelievable that such a horrible thing could happen to a family that's already gone through so much.
Why is the judge not understanding that somehow might be the case? That's crazy.
Well, I think it has something to do with the way Sarah is dealing with it. She's at a bit of a, you know, a lot of people who are legitimately insane fight the insanity plea, even though their lawyers are putting in the plea on their behalf. And that seems to be what's happening here. The best thing you could look at, and this is just speculation, is that she might be wise enough to know that if she is convicted, she could get out in 15 or 20 years. But if she is found insane, she'll never get out.
Right.
That was just so true. It was such a shock. I remember when that happened, it was like, what the hell? What else can happen to this poor woman? You know, she's the face and the voice for the Long Island serial killer victims, and then her own daughter is so deeply mentally ill that she murders her. And it just seems like there's people in this life that just have a horrible cloud over them. And unfortunately, I believe that that poor woman was one of them. Bob, let's talk just a little bit about your book, if we can, because so many, well, practically all Web Sleuth members, I think, have read your book, Lost Girls. Truly. Let's talk briefly, just if you could tell us what prompted you to do this. Why? It was such an act of compassion to get the attention on these girls, just like what Josh and Rachel did. What started all of that?
Well, it was a bit of a gamble in a few ways. The first was that there was no solution to the mystery, and so to write a book with no solution, I needed to make sure that it would be a story that was important enough on its own that if it still wasn't solved by the time I finished writing it, it would still be compelling enough. And you know, we weren't living in a true crime moment in the world, in our culture. This was before Serial and before The Jinx. And the folks on web sleuths were going strong, but the broader culture hadn't caught up with web sleuths yet. And I was hoping to, I was a journalist for New York Magazine, hoping to become a nonfiction author, and I wanted to write the sort of books that lifted the veil on a corner of society that people hadn't seen before. And after I wrote a cover story about this case, I realized that this was that world, that prostitution in the age of the internet was something different, that it was drawing in people who might not have done it otherwise, and that we were living in a time in society where economic options were dwindling. And as your previous guest just talked about, there are women who come into it because they are financially strapped and can make a lot of money. And this book really became a story about class. It became a story about how a lot of the women in the book who became victims, their friends were working at Walmart or Dunkin' Donuts, and they were working as escorts, making as much money as their friends did in one night that their friends made in 3 weeks. And that really became the engine that drove the book. That, and as you said, it's a compassionate book. It's about looking clearly at these women's lives, not like they're martyrs, not like they're angels, and not like they're good girls gone bad, or not like they're plot devices in a Law and Order storyline, but that they're just human beings, that they are people who are making some very provocative choices, and how can we understand these choices?
Can I ask a question? Did you ever think, Bob, that we would be sitting here and the police chief would be arrested in this case, not necessarily for anything that he did in this case, but we do know that he in fact did drag his heels, and maybe that goes all the way up to the district attorney for what they have done. Did you ever think that it would kind of lead to this kind of systemic, I don't know what to call it,
Your guest, Jeff Proctor, he said that the best thing you can do in his area would be to try to shame people into acting. And his work is stunning, and the case that he's been reporting on is unbelievable. But in Long Island, they're way past shame.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, for decades, the Suffolk County and Nassau County Police Departments have had all kinds of problems. I mean, this is a there was a period a few decades ago in Long Island that with the Suffolk Police where their homicide division was accused of beating confessions out of people. This is ancient history. It's like the 80s or perhaps the early 90s. And there somebody did a review in Newsday of their cases and saw that they had this absolutely unreal 99% confession rate of any of the people they arrested, which is just nuts. Like, no police force should have a 99% confession rate. That means that they're beating the confessions out of people. And their reaction, the homicide squad, was to get T-shirts made that said 99% on them and wear 99% T-shirts around. I mean, this is the culture there is the bunker culture that I think Jeff talked about. They're like, don't tell us how to do our jobs. And you have a guy, Jet Burke, who's like the black bag man for the DA, suddenly becoming elevated in the police department. There's no way he wants the FBI anywhere close to what anyone is doing in his department. He wants them out of his department. So of course they're going to keep them away. Such an amazing thing to see on your show, to see the new commissioner, to see Sina say that it's important to note, coming up on the, what anniversary did he, the fifth anniversary of.
That was the fifth. Now we're the sixth.
Yeah, so he says 5 years into the case, I'm announcing that the FBI is coming in. I mean, it's a stunner, like 5 years. It took 5 years. It's just amazing.
And got to give it to Sini for being, I guess, transparent, but at the same time, I'm like, he's got to do a mea culpa, He has to admit it, but like he's like on the heels of the arrest of the previous police chief. Like I'm like, wow, did you just, am I sitting here and you're telling me on the heels of his arrest and incarceration? Like I can't believe it.
He comes off well in his interview with you guys where he says, he said it was a mistake. He said it was a mistake not to include the FBI earlier.
So good for him. I have to say, I'm sitting there with him, I believe he's honest, I believe he's transparent, but is the damage already done?
Well, I mean, they've lost a lot of time, whatever profile they have, I don't know if definitively the damage is already done, because a lot of these cases get solved 10 years later or 15 years later. So who knows? It's possible the FBI still has something to offer this case. Your show also had a lot to offer it. I mean, I just thought I'd point out to your,
yeah.
I mean, that my book, when I was working on the book, I was still trying to parse out things about, like, whether or not anyone actually heard Dr. Hackett say this or that. I was really working on a rudimentary level just to try to figure out where things actually sat. But your show has moved the ball forward by talking about that Asian male rendering, which is just amazing, that the guy who has that lead. And then the boyfriend of Jessica Taylor with the burlap connection, just amazing. And of course, Maureen's friend Sarah talking about the call she got that she remembers getting about a whorehouse in Queens. Another very interesting development that brings the case to Queens. And so who knows if this will hold? But it's nice. It's great that you did that work and got those elements of the case.
Right. Well, I can't. Again, if you haven't, just to the folks out there, and I know everybody has, I think at this point, because it's the Bible. If you haven't read Lost Girls, please do. And thank you, Bob.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And thank you, Rachel and Josh. It's been great to watch. It was great watching the show and great to be interviewed for it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob. He's a great guy. He's been on the show before, and we just adore him. Okay, our final guest for tonight, and we're getting a lot of information here because we are talking about the final two shows of the Killing season, the first season. And with us now is Greg Cooper. Greg is the founder of the Cold Case Foundation, also was in ViaCap, and we have lots of questions for Greg. So, Greg, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you. Thank you.
First of all, we have a lot of people on Web Sleuth who were appalled when they were watching Josh and Rachel's show, The Killing Season, to find out that there is a lot of data input that needs to be done in ViaCap. And that's one of the holdups, is getting the information in there so that the other law enforcement agencies, so everybody can see it, everybody can use it. But there's a big stack of papers with names and crimes and all of that that needs to be data input, I believe, is as simple as it gets. Any way we can volunteer to help ViaCap do something like that?
Well, you know, I think at the local level, I think law enforcement agencies would benefit from that type of an effort. The biggest problem that I see as a former program manager for ViaCap and now as the executive director for the Cold Case Foundation is a lack of understanding about the, number one, the existence of ViaCap and what specifically the services that ViaCap can provide to local law enforcement agencies.
Can you explain for a second just what ViaCap is?
ViaCap is the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, is what that stands for, and it's housed at the FBI. It's managed by the FBI. And it contains information on unsolved homicides, unidentified bodies, and missing mm-hmm. persons. Additionally, recently, in the last few years, they've added sexual assaults. And I would think that most of those, the types of sexual assaults we're talking about here, are those that may have what we refer to as serial offender characteristics in terms of the nature of the offense. And this is the national database that exists to house that information on those specific cases. But the problem is that ViaCap itself contains a very small percentage of those cases as represented in the country.
Now, you know, we've been talking for over a year about the limitations of VICAP. And maybe it's not right to say the limitation of VICAP, but kind of the model that has been introduced in that, you know, we have 17,000 different law enforcement agencies across the country, and that, you know, it's not mandated for them to report their homicide data to VICAP. Why is that?
Well, I suppose that would be a political question that needs to be answered. And we all understand the politics between the federal government, state government, and local government. So there's a lot of different, I think, opinions out there. But the bottom line is it is not mandated. Local law enforcement agencies are invited to participate, that is, to provide the information of those unsolved cases for the purpose of VICAP being then able to identify commonalities between similar types of cases around the country with the hope of determining if we have a common offender on certain clusters of and types of cases that have been committed. And then once that's been done, VICAP identifies those agencies who have submitted those unsolved cases, contacts them, and lets them know that there may be a cluster of unsolved cases that appear to be similar in nature. And then we'll assist those agencies in conducting a multi-agency investigative task force for the purposes of investigating those crimes. But again, it's for lack of participation that we just don't have the opportunity to take
Greg, can I just say, first of all, thank you for being so forthright and being so honest. You know, I appreciated you speaking to us, and I just want to tell everybody that your forthright comes from seeing the inner workings and just realizing not the problems, but how well it could work if everybody gave their information. Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. It's like any database, junk in, junk out. You know, it's the more cases that are put into the system, the more opportunity that we have to take individual cases and compare them to a national database and then identify commonalities. But as it is, there's just a very small representation of those unsolved cases, and so we come back with limited results. And I think another problem is, I think that, honestly, the FBI, while they have committed resources to VICAP for many years, there seems to be a lag in an effort to market, if you will, or promote the VICAP, what it does, what it can do, and its purposes throughout law enforcement agencies at a national level.
And let's also, like, you guys don't get a lot of money, or I shouldn't say you guys, because technically not there. But VICAP, actually, the computer system doesn't really get that much money out of that budget, correct? So so many people want to know what we can do, because it's very obvious, right? You know, we all know that computer systems are going to help. So my question is twofold. Number one, how can we get VICAP more money out of that government, and what can every person do who's so frustrated by what they hear?
Well, I appreciate that and the opportunity to give some thought to that. I honestly, I think it comes back to individuals connecting with their local police departments and their local representatives, political representatives at the local level, as well as at the state and national level, to request and encourage and ultimately even demand, if you will, that all of us at the national level who are in law enforcement commit ourselves to participate in this database. There are no other databases to provide the information of the problem that exists out there. This is the only database that exists, and without it, there's no way we can monitor this problem and identify and solve these cases.
So what I'm hearing is what I have to do is I go down or I call up my local police chief and I say, hey, chief,
I'm a taxpayer. I'm a citizen. Can I ask, are you voluntarily submitting your data to the VICAP system? And would you mind putting that in writing and sending me back in an email, right? Something like that?
Well, I think, to be as politically correct as possible, I think that, honestly, that I think that's expected, that law enforcement should be expected to do all that they can to resolve these cases, and they do at the local level. They're hounded daily by the unsolved cases that they have, and it's a huge pressure cooker out there that they're under, trust me. I've been a police chief, and I was with the FBI for 10 years, and I've worked with law enforcement agencies at the local and state and national level for almost 30 years now. So I understand the conflicts and the challenges that exist out there. But ultimately, we have to focus on the one, that one victim, that one family who needs answers to the unsolved case that involves their family member, for example. The Cold Case Foundation right now is involved with forming an alliance with the Council of State Governments to form an interstate compact agreement that will help bring all states together under one umbrella organization and enable those states to share information and ownership of and developing methods to gather the information across the United States and to encourage local law enforcement agencies from each state, the level of each state, encourage their own respective law enforcement agencies to participate in the VICAP system and develop further systems beyond that.
And do you feel like that's the way, like that's the easiest way for us to kind of mobilize as far as getting VICAP to be more national, you know, working from like the ground up from a state level to then feed into the national?
Well, you know, I think our strength as a country has been at least the principle of federalism, and that is at the state level. We seem independently as states to work more effectively and autonomously and yet mm-hmm. in partnership with each other. And when mm-hmm. you give each state the opportunity to manage and oversee their own, I think the ability that we give them to empower them with not only the authority, but the influence to make that happen within their own state, and you combine mm-hmm. that partnering with other states, it can be very effective. And interstate contract agreements are very, very effective.
Right. You know, I have one last question. I think you've kind of addressed it already, but just to kind of sum it up, after episode 6 and 7 or 6 aired, which kind of went big with the killing season, and we learned about VICAP and kind of limitations in that, all social media was saying, you know, how can I help? How can I help? How can I help? Can you just kind of reiterate at a personal level how each individual person in this country can kind of help to kind of, you know, move forward with VICAP being mandatory?
I would say, again, probably just repeat to contact your local mm-hmm. police departments, encourage them to utilize it, that the victims' associations that we have at the state and national level would also make that encouragement and implore the local agencies through their state representatives to adopt VICAP, utilizing it for the potential of solving their local crimes. I mean, let's take, for example, on an unsolved homicide. The information mm-hmm. only consists of about 100 questions that need to be answered, and it's check the box or multiple choice. So there's not a lot of information that has to be gathered. The VICAP form as it is an excellent outline for a homicide investigation, for example. If that information can be input into the system, then that agency can know that they have conducted a comprehensive homicide investigation. So it's a good tool to be used as well. So I would just encourage at the local level and state level and implore law enforcement agencies by those means to utilize VICAP and ensure, therefore, that it's going to be effective. Until we utilize, it's no good. It's like a car that's filled with gas. You know, if we don't put the driver in there, it's not going to do us much good. Or a car that doesn't have any gas, what good is it to us?
Right.
Great.
Well,
thank you so much. You've been a dog. Come on and help us. I want to give your title again because this is incredible. You're the executive director of the Cold Case Foundation, former manager of the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. We know it as VICAP. And, Greg, we will have you on again soon, my dear. Okay?
Great. Thank you very much. Good to be here with you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Okay, we're running out of time, but we have to talk about season 2 of The Killing Season. That is the number one question. I am just inundated. People want to know, is there going to be a season 2? Josh and Rachel, is there going to be a season 2? What can we do?
That's a damn good question. Well, it's tragically, it's not for lack of cases for us to look at. We have been working with Tom Hargrove on some places for us to look at, some serial murder cases that people haven't been made public, tragically, whether it's law enforcement not saying so because they don't want to scare people or whether they just don't know. And so we have numerous cases out there. We are waiting to get a green light on season 2. I don't know if it's going to happen. Saturday nights is a tough, kind of place for us to be. And it's tough in terms of getting a lot of people to watch. But thank you for everybody who did. And if you do want more, contact your A&E representative or put in the hashtag pound. We want killing season 2. Yes, we want killing season 2. And, who knows? The one thing I can say is I can't thank you enough, Tricia. I know this comes from the bottom of Rachel and my heart. We can't thank you enough. And honestly, we were moved by the amount of people who cared. And it was really beautiful and it was really humbling to see all the people who wanted justice just like we did.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody deserves it. And I think nobody knows that more than the web sleuth community. And hopefully something will happen. But, sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so let's keep shining a light on everything that we're doing. And I can honestly say that I believe everybody, by the sheer number of people watching and talking about this show, the word does spread. And I guarantee you, somewhere, some way, we have saved a life.
I absolutely believe that, Josh and Rachel. And thank you for your kind words about Web Sleuth. The members there are amazing. And on behalf of Web Sleuth, thank you both. You are the first two people that have actually picked up the camera and went out there and did the legwork and did the hard work that was needed to be done. So thank you both. I'm hoping that we're going to have you back on to discuss season 2. Remember, it's hashtag WeWantKillingSeason2. That's the number 2. That's for your Twitter account. Let's just let's break Twitter. Let's get that out there and let A&E know this is what we want. Josh and Rachel, thank you. We'll be talking to you again soon. I know we will.
Thank you so much.
Take care. Take care now. You be safe.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's it. Now, what we're going to do, everybody, is we're going to continue Web Sleuth Radio on Tuesday night, same time. We'll see you here next week, same time, same place. Thank you, Bessie, for your help, and thank our guests. Take care now. Bye-bye.